Hey, my name is Don Taylor. I'm an associate professor of public policy at Duke University, and I blog at The Incidental Economist. And I'm going to be talking with a friend and colleague of mine today, Harold Pollack.
And I'm Harold Pollack. I teach social service administration at the University of Chicago. And I write for the reality-based community and occasional contributor other places, including The Incidental Economist.
And Harold and I today are going to be talking some about health reform in general and the work of the Super Committee, but specifically we're going to be talking about the CLASS Act, or the demise of the CLASS Act, the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Act, part of health reform that on which the plug was just pulled. Then we're going to talk a bit about some of the themes in my book called Balancing the Budget as a Progressive Priority. We're going to talk a bit about the politics of the budget deficit and the role of social insurance in American society. And then we're going to finish up with some discussions of college sports and particularly issues around the fairness or lack of fairness in how student athletes now don't really share in the economic largesse that they help to produce for universities like mine.
Pretty full agenda.
Yeah, pretty full agenda. So a couple weeks ago, an interesting thing about the CLASS Act, Harold and I were trying to even figure out, remember what the heck it stood for. So it is the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Act. And both of us said what we thought it stood for, and it was something close to that, but not exactly that. And it sort of brings home one of my pet peeves, that long-term care is really kind of a backwater health policy issue, but it really affects millions of people.
Yeah, it's really striking that this is so intimate to our humanity. We're all going to face this problem either ourselves or with our families, but it's something that the policy process just seems allergic to dealing with in an adult way in all sorts of ways.
Sarah, what do you think that's about? Is it just that it's not attractive to think about that someday you might need somebody to, you know, help you eat, get dressed, take a bath?
I think that's part of it. I think that there's a forbidding complexity to it because people's circumstances are so varied. And I think it's something that that we really, as a society, we just have not really confronted the need to alter our social insurance system to be well-suited to the needs of a population that is going to grow to old age, often with significant disability attached to it. And I think that I was listening to Governor Perry talking about how he wants to see government expenditures stabilize at around 18% of gross domestic product. And I'm just thinking, you know, with issues like long-term care looming, that is so completely unrealistic that that you don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Actually, in my book, I say, you know, we should seek balance at 21% of GDP, and that'll be hard enough. I mean, 18% is a fantasy, I think. In one sense, it's mathematically possible, but there's no way that I think our society, our culture would accept the cuts necessary for that. If we're looking back at CLASS, just a bit of background, you know, long-term care is really help and support to enable people to deal with disability, things that a lot of us take for granted, eating, dressing, bathing. And now most families are the first line providers of long-term care. Once people get too ill to be cared for by their families, they often go to nursing homes. And a lot of folks don't realize it. The Medicaid program, which we think of as health insurance for poor people, pays about 43% of all nursing home expenditures in the U.S. So that's the default that we had before the passage of CLASS, and it's the default that we still have today.
Yeah, it's really something. If you imagine, suppose that you went on to get your morning newspaper tomorrow, and it's raining and it's slippery, and you slipped on the steps, and you suffered a catastrophic spinal cord injury, but you were still, you're still cognitively intact, and you're still a professor of public policy at Duke University. But you got to change your life around so that you can live in the family home and maximize your functioning. And you start to say, what do we have in America that would help you do that, that would keep you out of that nursing home? And you realize, you know, we really don't have a whole lot. And It's something that the Class Act was an effort to try to provide some help with that if you needed to use the money to have a relative help take care of you or to put a ramp on your house. But for various reasons, Class was, was not successful in creating a structure to do that. And, Class may, Class is in abeyance. It has not actually been overturned. It's just the Obama administration has said they currently don't see how to do this in a way that is self-financing. We'll talk about what that act actually is in a minute. But if Class goes away, the problem is certainly not going to go away. And independent of Class, there's the issue of what do we do about nursing home care and many other aspects. I should probably say something about Class. The idea behind Class was that as a worker, you could, if you earned at least a few thousand dollars a year, there's some wiggle room in how much you'd have to earn. You could sign up for Class. You'd pay premiums for the first 5 years. You would not be eligible for benefits. You'd be paying in premiums to get vested in the program. And then later that point, if you got injured, say in that accident I described, you could start drawing benefits depending on which activities of daily living you needed help with. And it was described during the, I think many people who follow public policy loosely, follow health reform loosely, think of the criticisms of Class as a Ponzi scheme, because it turns out it helped with the CBO scoring, because you had 5 years of people paying into Class when they couldn't draw any benefits, so that sort of looked really good in terms of a 10-year budget projection. It's really not a Ponzi scheme. I think that was a very unfair categorization, but the question then became, what premiums do you set and what kinds of restrictions do you set on who could sign up for this thing so that it's financially viable?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the big idea of Class is to try to make planning for long-term care a normal part of being a young adult, and it's not that now. And so the goal or the idea then is to get folks to sign up and think about this and plan for it when they're young. And the benefits that will be provided, as Harold said, on the order of $50 to $75 per day, that wouldn't finance the stay in a nursing home, but it very well could be the difference between somebody being able to put together a flexible plan to keep them in their home or not.
By the way, one thing I would add about Class is it shows the importance of an individual mandate in two ways. We've had this individual mandate debate in other aspects of health reform for quite a while. Long-term care insurance is an area where the mandate is really important, because if the only people who want to sign up for a long-term care program are people who know that they have a serious health problem, the premiums are going to be quite expensive. That's the first problem. And a lot of the actuaries and economists at the Congressional Budget Office really wrestled with that. But the second thing is that it just becomes much more unpredictable what's going to actually happen. So you could imagine that Class gets started and a lot of those young, healthy adults get the message that, hey, I need to be planning for my future. And a lot of those young adults sign up, and then the program becomes pretty cheap because the average risk's pretty good. And everything moves along very well, and we provide a good level of protection for millions of people. That's the bright image. The not so bright image is, by the way, the bright image might be something like 6% of people who are eligible sign up for it. It doesn't require a huge amount, but it has to be more than the small group of people who know they have serious health problems or are pretty much guaranteed to sign up. The dystopian image is you get 2% of the population. It's very heavily weighted towards very sick people. The premium becomes very high. And therefore, young and healthy people look at this and they say, I'm not going to pay $200 a month or $300 a month to sign up for this benefit. It's just too expensive for me. And at that point, you start to really unravel the entire program because of what's sometimes called the adverse selection death spiral. So if we had an individual mandate, it would be cheaper for most people, for everybody really. It would also be just more predictable what actually is going to happen. I still have not seen a good analysis of what actually is likely to happen if the Class program is rolled out. And in some ways I think it's probably good that it's been put in abeyance, because in order to really be successful you need a full court press with this thing, with benefit managers from big companies and universities really encouraging everybody to sign up, so that we get a good cross-section of people who sign up, so that now they're healthy, but 10 years from now, if they need the program, the program's there in a stable way.
You know, what class actually needs is a mandate that we can call something else politically, right? So if you look at Representative Paul Ryan's Patient's Choice Act, which is his replace part for the sort of the non-Medicaid, non-Medicare part of the system, his act actually, or that piece of legislation, depends on aggressive auto-enroll procedures. So, for example, when you go to get your driver's license renewed, you know, you sort of nudge people into signing up. So it's interesting. There are plenty of policy things we could do if we could pool the risk and get the program set up. It's very frustrating because class has been treated only as really a political scout, but there seems to be nobody talking about the reality of long-term care and what the heck are we going to do about it.
Now, one thing we should also talk about, I don't know if we're ready to segue in the conversation into talking about people with pretty significant disabilities who are sometimes called dual eligibles. Those are people who are on Medicaid because they have financial issues often related to their disability, but they're also on Medicare because maybe they had to leave a job and qualify for disability, or maybe they were disabled from birth and ended up in the Medicare program that way. Shall we shift over to talking about the
absolutely
this very expensive population? Why are dual eligibles something that policy wonks care about, even though nobody else has really heard this term before?
Well, another category of dual eligibles are just elderly people who have become impoverished paying for long-term care, so they've ended up in a nursing home. If you look at the dual eligibles, they're just essentially, they're about 8.5 or 9 million of them. They're probably the 8.5 or 9 million most vulnerable people in our country. And so there's, from a fiscal or financial standpoint, they're incredibly expensive to care for, but also just from a moral standpoint, I mean, how we care for those people, I think, says a lot about our country. So that's where, to me, it should be possible to actually reduce the amount of money we spend per capita while improving quality, because there's so many perverse incentives in having Medicaid and Medicare involved in paying for their care. But it's just so much easier to identify the problems than it is to move the solutions.
There's so many issues with this, one being that it's probably ridiculous to have the states bearing the financial responsibility for this group. States right. don't run the programs very well. It's killing state budgets, and it just introduces tremendous complexity and problems with no real benefit in terms of the quality of services or the economy of services that are offered, to sort of give the states responsibility that they don't want for a very expensive population that they can't really afford to take care of properly.
Yeah, to me it seems kind of obvious or inevitable that if we're ever really going to deal with the duals, both on a cost and a quality basis, we're going to have to make somebody responsible for financing all their care. And I think my preference for the dual eligibles would be to federalize all of their care. So, as you say, shift the long-term care costs from the states to the federal government. There's all sorts of perverse incentives when you have two payers involved. Just as a quick example, many states pay what are called nursing home bed hold days. So if you have someone who becomes ill, let's say a fever, they're sent to the hospital. Let's say this person's very elderly and is demented. There's a lot of questions about whether they can really benefit from this hospitalization and why the care couldn't be delivered in a nursing home. But from the nursing home standpoint, they can get bed hold payment days from Medicaid. They've then shifted the cost of caring for this person when they're very ill to the Medicare program, and we end up with something that's very expensive that's probably not improving, you know, the quality of life of that human being.
By the way, let me get a little personal here. So I've written a lot over the past several years about taking care of my brother-in-law, who he lived with his mom, my mother-in-law, for the first 35 years of his life. And he's actually a dual-eligible person. One day, my mother-in-law just died suddenly, and we had to put him in our minivan and move him into our house, where, you know, we have two young daughters, and suddenly he moved into the room down the hall. And he's this intellectually disabled man. He was 340 pounds when he moved in. He had dental issues, dermatological issues. He had deep vein thromboses. He was on round-the-clock IVs for some period of time that my wife was piloting, and we spent 3 years with him living, almost 3 years, him living in our home, and he's now very happy living in a group home near us. But one of the striking things about taking care of him was when we moved him from New York State to our home, he immediately lost his Medicaid card. He lost all the social services that he was getting just because he crossed state lines. And one of the real problems taking care of someone who's on Medicaid is you just have to worry, what state am I in? What happens if I have to move him to a new place where he has to be re-enrolled, get on waiting lists for new services and so on? And his Medicare, which he was on, was completely seamless. It took us 5 minutes at the local Social Security office to change some paperwork. And it was very fortunate for us that his Medicare continued uninterrupted, because we went for some months, wrestling with bureaucratic problems enrolling him in Medicaid, and he had all kinds of very serious medical problems at the time. So it was just a real mess for our family right at the moment that we were dealing with a family tragedy and trying to deal with selling his mom's home and dealing with helping him adjust to a completely new life, helping our family adjust to having him living in our home. He did a beautiful job, but it was so much more difficult in so many ways because of the very clumsy way that Medicaid operates, and often the very inhumane way that the programs fail to show a human face to the families that have to deal with them.
Yeah, it's a difficult story, and that kind of just reality is what's been lost. I mean, there's just been so little acknowledgement and sort of the victory lap of the CLASS Act being slowed down or not implemented. But really, what are we going to do about these issues?
Especially, I would just add, it's also a very difficult time because states are curbing services right now. And in the case of the intellectually disabled, kind of for the first time ever in some ways, they're really, because states are in such fiscal trouble, they're cutting down on services that, dental care, vision care. Some states are limiting Medicaid inpatient days to, there's an effort to try to reduce inpatient days to a maximum of 10 days a year in one state. And it's in fact in South Carolina they get the record for the most Dickensian cuts, where they cut both hospice care services and also cut the number of meals on wheels that elders were able to get per week. So we're in a policy environment right now where disabled people who depend on Medicaid are really having a hard time.
Yeah, I think, and the other end of the, just sticking with the personal theme issue, another way that long-term care can just kind of invade your life is really just in the last 10 days or so, my wife and I have decided that we're going to need to move, move into a house that has a place where her mother can come and live with us. And this is not really her mother's desire. It's not really my wife's first desire, because we'd like for her mother to still be independent, but my father-in-law died about a decade ago, and now her mother is needs help, and so we're trying to trade off how much mortgage can we take. I've got an 11th grader, a 9th grader, and a 5th grader, so I'm thinking about how to deal with the long-term care for my mother-in-law, which I think is something that I should be doing. I mean, that's part of my responsibility. But also then thinking of, how am I going to pay for college for my kids and things like that. The thing about long-term care is, it is something that's kind of this quiet sort of reality that is a very difficult thing for our country to deal with, and it would be much better if we dealt with it in a more head-on, straightforward manner that gave families more options.
Absolutely. By the way, in both of our cases, this is the American way of aging. In your case, that's what many of us will be taking care of aged parents, and someday we'll be aged parents ourselves. At least you've got three kids to help take care of you.
Yeah.
My wife's already
decided which one is absolutely not going to care for us, which one's most likely, and which one's in between. So.
Well, be nice to your kids, and I'll try to do the same. But also, you know, we are people. So my wife had to leave the workforce to take care of her brother, and she's actually an advanced practice nurse, so she could do a lot of the case management, just the direct care. But you know, we're in a situation where I have a steady job, and so do you. So we can do some things to help take care of our family that millions of Americans can't.
Yeah,
and that's something that, when I listen to people talk about the burden of taxation, I can tell you that having this kind of a family crisis hit, I would say that one of the things that I'm least afraid of is that someone would raise my taxes a little bit when I think about all of the other risks in life that we run. I was basically raised that we should have a nice social insurance system so that we can help take care of all those people that need help. And one of the chastening experiences about my life over the past 7 years is boy, even with the job that I have as a professor at the University of Chicago, there's just no way that we could take care of my brother-in-law without the services that Medicaid pays for and the other services that he needs, which would have bankrupted us despite the fact that I have a very nice job at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, there's a recent study put out by AARP, and they estimated the economic cost of caregiving, and they put it at $450 billion a year. Just to put that in context, the total, all payers put together for nursing home care in the United States last year is about $175 billion. So, you know, almost three times as much economic cost being imposed on families. And I can hear and get the idea that, you know, it's honor thy father and mother. You know, it's a very practical representation of that sort of moral principle. But one thing that really bothers me is I do not think people understand these costs. And there's really like a learning problem. It's like you only deal with your mother once. You only have one mother. And it's often like people take the experience, their caregiving experience with them, and we're not sort of learning from it and building a system that provides, you know, a more, I think the way I put it, a more humane and flexible safety net.
By the way, I would also add to that, we have to actually do these things right in a disciplined way, because one of the things that the Class Act controversy, I think, does point out, and the other issues come up, such as home care, which is often very expensive and can be very wasteful, you know, when it's implemented badly, is, hey, we have to make these programs financially sustainable. And that means that those of us who are advocates for the disabled, the programs for the disabled, have to be credible in what we propose and have to explain how these things will be financed over the long run so that they're really going to be there for people. And I do think that in something like the Class Act, that probably it's probably a good thing that it's in abeyance right now, because it really has to be rethought in its implementation, so that I think probably we need to do this in a way that restricts it to people to a little bit more on the side of, let's start with healthy workers and make sure that we get this thing to work right, and we recruit people into the program and make sure that we might disappoint the advocates for the disabled who need services for people who are who might not qualify if we tighten up the eligibility. But let's get this thing going in a way that genuinely works and is credible, and then think about how to expand it. Because I do think that when you think about the big dollars involved and the fact that this is going to unfold over the next generation, we really have to earn the trust of the American public in doing this thing right.
Yeah, and actually, just to segue, I mean, I think the main point of the book that I've written, you know, Balancing the Budget as a Progressive Priority, it's basically saying that progressives actually need a sustainable budget more than conservatives do, given our view of the role of government. And I think, in one sense, we probably, I mean, there are blind spots on the other side, so to speak, as well. But, you know, the more you believe in government spending and government programs having a key role, I mean, we've got to have a growing, you know, economy that's going to produce predictable tax revenues and, you know, can finance these programs. And just politically, I think, we've really got to, as you said, Harold, we have to be credible, and we kind of need to drive that conversation, I think.
Yeah, does that mean we should have a value-added tax?
I don't know. Actually, I'm not really sure. The short answer is I don't know. To me, the biggest thing that we need is we need some rough speaking target of expenditures that's going to be, you know, what amount of our economy is going to be redistributed via government. In my book, I say 21% of GDP. And once we get, roughly speaking, that level set, then I personally am somewhat agnostic about exactly what the structure of the tax code would look like. What are you thinking?
Well, one, I actually think that 21% is awfully optimistic. I think it's going to be higher, and it probably should be higher in my own personal view. One issue being that we talk a lot in healthcare about bending the cost curve, and I think we have to appreciate we're not going to bend the cost curve for a long time. And there's just a, when I listen to policymakers talking about the budget picture over the next decade, I think people are in a dreamland when they talk about reducing government expenditures compared to today. When you think about, 10 years from now, healthcare is going to be a lot more expensive than it is right now. And nothing that we're doing right now is incredibly likely to slow that down that much over the next decade. And, so I think, I have a couple regrets from I used to be a special correspondent for the New Republic during health reform. And I have a couple regrets from my reporting back then. And one is, I once did a review of Zeke Emanuel and Victor Fuchs' book on health reform where they proposed a bat. And I kind of made fun of it because I said, let's just find another way to make health reform completely unrealistic politically. Let's just throw a huge new tax on top of all the other controversial things in there. And I think in retrospect, they were absolutely right in terms of what needed to be done. I think we need to have a tax system that can support a larger government, because just from the growth of healthcare spending, that's what we're going to have. And if we don't have that tax structure, my biggest fear is that we'll just destroy everything else in the government. We'll support Medicare, we'll support Medicaid, although Medicaid will be below the level that I would like it to be at. And we'll pay the Social Security checks and the national debt. And then we'll discover we just have so little money in the cash register that everything from NIH to the FBI to the Environmental Protection Agency will be gutted before we confront the problems that we have. I think the discretionary part of the government, we've just been cutting that consistently over time, and it's a very, very foolish long-term policy for the country.
Yeah, I think like I say, my biggest issue is we need to set some realistic level of spending, and then over long periods of time, we know we've got to pay for that amount of spending. In terms of tax reform, what sort of I pitched in my book, it wasn't what I went into the book thinking, but it's what I convinced myself of, and that was the following. We should actually end the corporate income tax, which obviously is not typically associated with a progressive, which I would call myself a progressive. But I looked at that, and over the past 30 years, the corporate income tax has only brought in 10% or less of total revenues. If we went back to the 50s, it was like 40% of the revenues. And I've become convinced you just can't tax corporations. They have too much power. They have too much access. And so what I would prefer is let's just end the corporate income tax. Let's tax capital gains and dividends as normal income and keep aggressive tax structure and just raise the top rate. I think it would be a much more efficient way to do it.
By the way, I've become much more of a partisan over time. I'm by instinct a technocrat. But watching American politics over the past decade or so has really made me more of a Democratic partisan than I used to be, because I think the dilemma that you are describing is really that the excessive political power that affluent people have in America, and how we have to really confront that. And if we get rid of the corporate tax, that has to be I'm not enough of a tax expert to know if that's a great idea, but I think clearly the part that you're describing is we have to tax individuals in at a higher rate when they're at the upper ends of the income distribution. And, you know, sort of starting with where you and I are earning and up. I think, you know, sort of the affluent middle class and up. And, that is politically very, very hard. I sent an email around a couple months ago where I asked a bunch of very smart policy wonks and reporters and people that I knew who had been following, the 2008 election and President Obama's first couple of years. And I said, what has really surprised you the most about what's happened in the past couple of years? And one of the most consistent responses I got was, I'm surprised by the ability of the most affluent to not only get the policy outcomes they want, but to also shift public opinion in their direction. And, I mean, the popular opposition to estate taxes is one of the obvious examples where, you know, just it touches such a tiny fraction of the American
right.
population.
Right.
But people have bought into the idea that the death tax is somehow, you know, is really a bad thing. And I think that in order for good technocratic policy to be made, we really have to confront that, and we also have to confront there's an asymmetry between the two parties that, you know, where the Democrats come in and what their goal seems to be is to, we want to put through policies that we favor. So health reform, we'll spend the first 2 years of the Obama administration fighting over health reform. And with Republicans, when they have power, it's much more likely to be their goal to say, well, let's consolidate our own power. I think John Bernstein is the person that that sort of educated me in his writing to some of this, that we really have two parties that just take a different approach where the Republicans are much more focused on how do we get the levers of power and make sure that they're in our hands in a way that allows us to dictate outcomes. And I think the kinds of policies that you advocate, which are basically very centrist policies and very sensible policies in terms of long-run fiscal responsibility for the country, we're not going to get there unless we somehow confront, you know, these political factors that I was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the criticisms would be that, like, the Democrats really negotiated with themselves in health reform. And a few people have told me that about my book. They say, well, Don, you know, I mean, what I really was trying to do was, for example, in health reform, I pitched the idea, you know, what we really need is a bipartisan, some sort of political deal so we can move ahead on health reform. So in my opinion, I completely agree with Harold that it's unlikely that we're going to deal with cost, at least very much soon. It'll be hard always, but we need to just get started. So to me, for example, I was saying, what if we had some modification where we had a true federally guaranteed universal catastrophic insurance system that would actually get rid of the individual mandate? Because if you just directly provided it, then, you know, you could do away with sort of the controversy of the Supreme Court case and on and on and on. And
isn't that an irony? If you just have a public program that directly provides it, you get away from this entire constitutional issue. Sort of like the single payer advocates maybe should hope that the Supreme Court overturns the mandate.
I mean, in one sense, if the Supreme Court overturns the mandate and the entire law goes away, I would say that gives us the best chance to have a single payer a decade from now.
That's probably true.
As long as we're muddling through with kind of a either individual mandate or some kind of, let's come up with things that we're not going to call a mandate, but they're auto-enroll procedures like Representative Ryan's policies in the Patient's Choice Act, you know, then that's in many ways the last thing, you know, that we'll end up with. And just in policy terms, the conservatives, Republicans need a health reform deal a lot more than Democrats do in policy terms, because the D's have got all sorts of ideas, and I just can't find any evidence that the Republicans would ever drive the agenda. It's sort of like what you were saying.
It's amazing how the fact that health reform is the centerpiece of the Obama administration has just poisoned everything about any kind of conversation that you might want to have about all the policy areas we talk about. By the way, I must say, this is going to be like the Blogging Wonks edition of Blogging Heads.
Yes, but, sorry about that.
So please forgive us, those of you who are still listening. but one of the things that really struck me, another surprise that I had in the health reform debate, is I thought that after the bill was passed, that a lot of Republicans would come forward and present Republican ideas to to implement health reform, or there would be a point where the politics would move from an entirely partisan politics to one where the interest groups would weigh in with what they wanted, and it would be somewhat tempered from what we've from the debate that you saw in say the middle of 2009 when with the Tea Parties showing up at the town halls and so on. That just never happened.
Yeah,
there's just no way to the substance of health reform is bipartisan.
Yeah.
But it is all happening within the Democratic Party, and I think it's going to continue that way. And if, by the way, I think all of the people who are calling for a greater degree of bipartisanship, and who are sort of saying like the Tom Friedman view of the world, the plague on all their houses, this sort of thing, they're making this problem much worse.
Mm.
Because what's happening is that a conservative approach that loosely speaking is identified with the Tea Party is proving politically successful. And not only is that damaging the Obama presidency and may lead to Obama's defeat, it's hard to say, but it's also completely disempowered the moderate Republicans who have their own policy approaches to controlling healthcare costs, to expanding access in a market-oriented way, and so on. If you're a moderate Republican right now, you have, within your own party, you really have a very weak argument for why your view should be taken seriously by the leadership. You have a core of the Republican base that rejects that kind of moderation. You have a lot of people in the House, in the Republican side, who reject that. And you also just have the political reality that being extreme has been fairly successful, and that there's just the incentives to produce moderate compromise are pretty limited. And the public is very disgusted that Washington can't get its act together to do the kind of bipartisan policymaking we might want, but it doesn't translate into blaming or creating political costs for the people who are really the source of the problem.
Mm.
The fact is that President Obama, who's a very moderate figure, is the guy standing there while the economy is not working well, and while the healthcare policy debate is so acrimonious, and the average voter is looking up and saying, well, he's the guy standing there while all this is happening, and many are blaming him. And if that's what the dynamic is, as John Shade and many other people point out, it would be political malpractice for Republicans to be a little more responsible about this stuff. So I think probably a lot of the conversation that you're talking about, it will not occur during an Obama presidency, because there's just no incentive for the president's opponents to do that. And since President Obama owns everything that people don't like about the healthcare system, his political adversaries just wouldn't want to get in the weeds to offer their own proposals, where they would start to own some of these problems as well.
Yeah, maybe the what would be, I don't know if I really believe this, but let me try it out here. If the Republicans, let's say they kept the House and they took the Senate in 2012, and President Obama is reelected, which I actually feel reasonably confident that he will be. I wonder if then the Republicans would actually own, they would own the Congress. They would have to produce. I mean, having a 51-52 seat, in the Senate, we've seen that that's not exactly a formula to wield lots of power.
Absolutely.
So.
Although it's a little unpredictable, and this goes beyond my competence, but you have this group of centrist Democrats who are kind of halfway in the Senate, who are halfway between the Democrats and Republicans in a lot of ways. And they're, by the way, some of the prime beneficiaries of the Senate rules that make you get 60 votes to accomplish a lot, because they're always the people that are going to be at the margin there. So, Ken Conrad is never going to really support getting rid of the filibuster, because that's just basically minimizing his own personal influence if we got rid of that. But that's, you're raising a very good question. I don't know what that outcome would be. I also think if the economy improves and President Obama's reelected, then his entire persona changes. And then all of a sudden he becomes the guy who rolled the dice on health reform and won and weathered this tremendous storm and was able to get himself reelected, and then all of a sudden, instead of all these stories about how the president's failing and he's not able to convince people to do stuff, the stories start to become the president, he's riding high, and he's going to be able to watch healthcare reform implemented with millions of people getting insurance, on his watch. And so it's amazing how high stakes the 2012 election is in that respect.
Right.
Shall we shift over to some stuff that we disagree about?
Sure.
One of them is college sports. Now, I teach at the athletic powerhouse of the University of Chicago.
Right.
We got rid of our elite athletics decades ago.
And I think it's one of the few examples of a university that's ever done that.
I'm not sure that that was a smart move, actually, strategically for us. I think we are known as the university. Our public relations people have spent many years trying to play down the idea that we are the place that fun comes to
die.
But I think that the fact that we got rid of our Division I athletics makes it a little harder for them to make that sales pitch. I think all of our Nobel Prizes and stuff, which we're very proud of, also kind of feed into that where fun comes to die too in a certain
way. Right. And I think actually, Duke has Duke's niche really, and this would be something that would be plenty controversial with some of the faculty here. I think our niche in highly ranked universities are when you have kids that say, I want a balanced college experience, a lot of times what that practically means is they like the party and they like sports. And so we're sort of fighting the opposite kind of issue, I think. We've sort of joined the big-time sports with academics, and so maybe both of our universities are fighting their own demons.
Absolutely. And I'd say Duke and Michigan and Stanford, there's a few universities that have been relatively non-disgraceful in the way that big time athletics is pursued.
Right.
And I mean, certainly, if you're an elite athlete and you're not going to make it into the NFL or a place like Michigan or Stanford, if you're in football, or Duke, if you're in basketball, becomes very attractive.
Right.
But I would say in the main that everyone understands the system is just a broken system. I've thought for years, that there should just be that the NCAA should just be forbidden from regulating players' compensation. I think we should mention Taylor Branch's article in The Atlantic that's gotten so much attention, which captures what I've believed for a while, that the amateur ideal is a fundamentally exploitative way to think about the student athletes in college sports.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting example because when I would look at the issue of college sports, and especially when I read Branch's account or even Charlie Klotfelter, my colleague here at Duke's book about the economics of sports, I recognize unfairness, but my first thought when I'm thinking about this, I really love sports. I'm thinking, how in the world can we maintain this incredible sort of competitive I'm thinking about the sports first, and I know you were coming at it more of an economics issue first, and I think maybe I'm almost viewing it like some sort of public good or at least some kind of good where the benefits are just incredibly broadly spread, but I would agree there are problems with what's happening with student-athletes or with – go ahead.
Well, what I like about Taylor Branch's piece is that it just cuts through the hypocrisy. I mean, a lot of the discussion about college athletics seems to be – how do we deal with this in a way that's fair and preserves what we like about college sports? So how do you deal with are the scholarships too low, or is it fair to say, well, you're playing football for Stanford, so you get it, but you're getting a full athletic scholarship in return for that? And I just think that's fundamentally misframed. Suppose that we could improve public health in America by limiting the salaries of nurses and say, well, nurses have all sorts of great reasons to be nurses, and why should they be motivated by money? And, if we just kept their salaries capped at $60,000, it'd be easier to send, or $40,000, be easier to send nurses out to rural Montana to take care of people. That's just not the way that we run the American economy, and it's not the way we think about people's labor. It's sort of astonishing to me that, some of the examples in Taylor's book, I'm using his first name like we're buddies, we've never met, some of the examples are so obvious. A kid is penalized by the NCAA because he takes off a shirt and he autographs it and he sells it.
Right.
And you go into the university store and they've got just racks of shirts with his number on it and they're selling it. And, you know, I just think that there should be a court decision that's like one paragraph long that just says the NCAA has no authority to regulate player compensation and then let it go. And college sports will be what it's going to be. And maybe it'll be harder for the canoe team to be cross-subsidized by the big football program. But, you know, that's why should elite football players be limited in their compensation so that we can, you know, as a way to pay for somebody else's sporting activity? It just, you know, to me it makes, there's very little justification for it. And the fact that the coaches are so astronomically paid makes it, you know, particularly glaring. And actually, I'm not sure who the beneficiaries are of the current system. Most universities are losing money on this stuff, at least directly. Yeah. But there's this whole class of coaches and officials and a bureaucracy through the NCAA and related bodies that is, you know, that is selling rights to television programs and so on. And the structure just has no legitimacy from top to bottom.
You know, when I hear you analyze it in economic terms like that, I mean, what you say makes a great deal of sense. Somehow, like, deep in my gut, that it doesn't make sense, though. And when I unwind why that might be, I grew up in eastern North Carolina, and my connection – and I went to the University of North Carolina, so and I work at Duke. I realize that's
– That is really a
– Right. So when I was a freshman in Winston dorm, I would have said I'd rather starve than work at Duke and all that. But as my wife says, the check's cash. So, but anyway, it's actually doable. But my dad, I think, took me to a football game when I was about 5 years old, and it was this incredible thing when the Tar Heel players ran out and they were carrying the North Carolina flag. And I thought, man, they're representing our state. You know, I'm from North Carolina. And the only college I ever applied to was UNC. I tell people it was my dream school. It never crossed my mind to apply somewhere else. And, you know, my first hero was Phil Ford, who was the point guard of the 1977 team that lost in the NCAA championship game.
Yeah, Ernie Grunfeld was on that team, I think. Yeah, he was he went to high school with my cousin who was on the team. I think Ernie got the ball a little more than my cousin did.
So somehow, if you look at Charlie Klopfelter's book, he talks some about how sports connects people to universities. And I think part of what he would be saying in a cost-benefit standpoint, it is definitely true that most academic programs run an operational deficit year to year, but you might not be we might not be measuring the benefits correctly. And how about this? I would offer this as sort of a midpoint between just sort of keeping what I think really has become sort of a lie, and what you're saying is let's just let it be a straight economic issue. And maybe take men's basketball and football, which are the two most lucrative sports, and do a couple things. One, say all the scholarships have to cover the full cost of attendance. So that's everything, the full cost of attending. Second, each player should get some sort of living stipend, you know, because, you know, you read these stories, you have a kid who's a star, but he doesn't even have enough money to buy a pizza on the weekend. And that's sort of let's say every player, regardless of ability, gets something. And then third, have a market mechanism where we say players actually share in the revenue generated by their likeness in their jersey, you know, the situation you were mentioning. Because I think it's the case, if you look at detailed, you know, analyses of royalties, it's a very small proportion of the players that are really generating large amounts of the revenue.
Well, those are great. I mean, everything you suggested would really be an improvement over the current system. But I think I'm just more nihilistic. It's funny, in this, even though I'm such a left-wing person in so many ways, in this I'm a very libertarian market guy, you know, I think each school should be allowed to do whatever it wants to do. And, you know, if the Tar Heels coach wants to go and say, I'm going to give everybody full scholarships and I'm going to take my $2 million salary as head coach and I'm going to take half of it and I'm going to distribute it among the players, and goes to the homes of, you know, goes into that rural North Carolina home and talks to the point guard and says, you know, you come to North Carolina, we'll give you a good education, you'll be a Tar Heel, that next generation of Don Taylors will look up to you. And by the way, you're going to get a check for $30,000 a year on top of your scholarship. I don't see anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Michigan wants to say, well, we don't pay our players, but you get to come here and be at University of Michigan, which has, you know, which has these great aspects to it, you know, that's great. I just think that there should not be a centralized body that prevents players from determining their market value and deciding accordingly. By the way, I think at the other end, I would also pay more attention on the other end. I think that the idea that players who try to sort of test out their market value, hire agents, go into the draft, see where they're going, I think that the idea that you would be ruled ineligible for college athletics if you're pursuing basically sensible things to see if you have a career as a professional athlete, I think those rules should also all be stricken. And, and then we should let this, you know, I think that a great school like North Carolina, they, you know, maybe they wouldn't have to pay too many of their players very much because people would genuinely want to come and you know, be on the team. Now, whether this would destroy the magic and the romance of college sports, that's another question, but I don't view that. It might be a benefit rather than a cost if we sort of moved some of that magic out of big-time college athletics and moved it into maybe minor league athletics or the NBA or wherever. I mean, I do think, you know, we are universities. There's no, you know, the idea that we are sort of providing this service for the midlife crisis, you know, men of America, I just don't see that as something that is so precious that we can't touch it.
Yeah, using a Duke example, last year Duke had a star point guard named Kyrie Irving. He's an interesting kid because he only played in 10 or 12 games because he got hurt, but he was the number one draft pick in the NBA draft. But, of course, now he's back at school at Duke because the NBA is locked out. But, of course, he's not able to play basketball. So,
yeah, that's insane to me. That's just insane.
Yeah, and it's I think actually the way baseball does the draft makes a little more sense. You can sign a letter of intent to play for a college, and then at the end of your senior year in high school, the major league has their baseball draft. You can be drafted as a high school kid, and you can decide you can go straight to the pros, which you can't do in basketball, or you can go to college. But if you go to college, you actually have to stay for 3 years. So. But there's a little more of a full information model there because you get to actually be drafted, look at your draft position, which will tell you some sense of how much you'd be paid, and then you can decide. Whereas in the NBA draft, and I think in college football for the NFL, once you declare for the draft, you've burned your amateur status. So each year there are kids who you know, declare for the NBA draft, and they're not actually drafted, and then they can't go back to college. So the system there is not set up to benefit the kids, I don't think.
No, it's not. And I think Branch just deserves a huge amount of credit for in sort of blunt fashion raising these issues. He uses this plantation analogy, which I sort of think should be. There's a lot of people in America who are facing worse injustices than college athletes, but college athletes are still being treated unfairly and hypocritically And there's really no justification for it that can stand up. And now, of course, I say this from the University of Chicago, we have perhaps the least at stake of any major university of our caliber. So so it's easy for me to make that argument. So we've covered a lot of ground today. You know, we talked about social. We haven't talked about. I was going to offer some bromides about social insurance, which I'm a big fan of. But maybe next Blogging Hats will do that. But okay. Anything else on our agenda that we haven't covered?
No, I think that was it. Was fun.
It was fun. Thank you. I hope that those of you who are listening that you know, send us hostile email and tell us how we can do better.
Yep.
And. I think shall we call it a day and go back to our regular regularly scheduled jobs now?
Yeah, let's do it. So good to talk to you.
Bye bye, sir.
All right, bye.